I'm ready.
You all ready to proceed? Yes? All right, counsel, you can go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Jack Fleeman. I represent the appellant, Nune Davidian. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time, if possible, for possible rebuttal argument. May it please the court. Today, we are asking for relief from the district court's denial of a request to grant child support for a handicapped adult child and the denial of a request to modify and extend alimony. I'll address the child support issue first. NRS 125B.110 states that a parent shall support his or her handicapped child beyond the age of majority until either the child is no longer handicapped or the child becomes self-supporting. Subsection 4 of the statute defines the handicap as an inability to engage in a substantial gainful activity by reason of any medically determinable physical or mental impairment, which can be expected to last for a continuous period of at least 12 months. The case of Edgington helps define what some of those words mean. It follows the Social Security Administration's determination of what those words mean. In this case, the party's child, who is now an adult, Alex, was 14 at the time of the divorce. The divorce was in 2012. At the time of the divorce, the parties knew that Alex had autism, and they in fact included some of that in their decree. It was a stipulated decree wherein they agreed that for legal custody purposes, they would follow the recommendations of a certain doctor if they had any disagreement as to what Alex's treatment should be.
Hey, counsel, can I ask why 6 years after Alex attained the age of majority and the child payments had already stopped, why wait 6 years to bring this motion?
Sure. That's a good question, Your Honor. The reason that my client waited 6 years was somewhat twofold. One was she was worried about going back to court. She had already gone back to court post-divorce and asked for a determination that the child was going to be handicapped beyond the age of majority and asked for child support. She was told at that time, the issue's not right. You have to come back after the child reaches the age of majority. Now, as to why it was 6 years, she was receiving alimony and she didn't want to go back to court and get rejected again. She only had limited funds. So she decided, I'll go back. Alimony's running out. I'll go back for both of these things. Also, while she was waiting, she was also trying to get Social Security disability for her son. So she applied for Social Security disability right after the child turned 18. He was still in high school, so he was still a minor under the child support statute. But that process took a few years. And in fact, he didn't get rated as a disabled or determined to be disabled until May of 2020, I believe. So she filed the motion in 2021, the following year. As her alimony was about to expire, she filed for both the child support under NRS 125B110 and the extension for alimony under NRS 125-150 sub 8. Like I said, Alex turned 18 in December of 2015. He was no longer a child for custody purposes, but he still was for child support purposes. When her alimony was about to end, she was still providing for Alex's need, and indeed, till this day, she still provides for his needs. She does his daily grooming. She cooks his meals. He's not able to do those things. So she went back to court knowing that she's pretty much a stay-at-home mom. She has to be there for him, and she needed an extension of alimony or child support. The $745 in Social Security income was not enough under the statute. If the child receives that type of assistance and it's enough to cover the child's needs, then that satisfies the parent's obligation, but it wasn't satisfying the needs.
Let me ask you a question. It's Perigary in Carson City. You had indicated that to the district court that he needed help grooming and so forth. But there was no discussion really whether he had a job or if he was able to work outside and whether or not he attended or graduated college.
Sure, Your Honor. I was not counsel at the lower court, but it is my review of the record. It does not look that those things were squarely addressed. I think some of that could have been addressed in an evidentiary hearing, which is one of the problems. There was no evidentiary hearing in this matter. It was just summarily denied. In terms of what the child has done in graduating from college or anything of the like, he's still not able to engage in substantial gainful activity. The Social Security Administration made the finding that he has a severe impairment, that he is disabled, that he hasn't engaged in any substantial gainful activity since January of 2016, when he was still a minor under the child support statute.
So, Counselor, are we supposed to divorce NRS 125C00451A from 125B110 in that the former requires modifications to child support be made only while the child is still a minor? So do we not construe those statutes together, or is 110 its own standalone with no time no time restrictions?
Your Honor, 125C.0045 is a permissive statute. It says that the court may do these things, including support, while the child is a minor. So it gives the court the ability to do these things while the child is a minor, but it's primarily 125C are the custody statutes. And so it's telling the court, you can, as long as it's in the best interest of the child, as long as the child's a minor, you can do these things: care, custody, maintenance, support, all of these things. NRS 125B110 is an exception to the general rule, which our case law states that if the child is an adult, this, in fact, you do have a requirement. You shall provide your child with support.
And that's irrespective of when you bring the motion seeking that support?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. The only caveat in the statute that's required, it's plain language of the statute. I don't believe that it's ambiguous. That's our position, is that the handicap has to have existed when the child was in the age minority. It could not have been cured at some point and then reestablished itself. It has to be a continuous handicap.
But and you're saying that it wasn't until 2020 where it was confirmed that he actually did have this disability?
The parties agreed that he had a disability and that he had a handicap. They didn't agree as to whether or not he was going to be self-supporting when he reached the age of majority.
Okay.
So the 2020 date is when the Social Security Administration issued its finding and backdated it to at least January of 2016 when mom filed the request for disability.
Understood. Thank you, counsel.
The court made several erroneous rulings. The first ruling was that it did not have jurisdiction to reinstate child support once the child reached the age of majority. As I stated before, the statute's clear on its face that the court absolutely has jurisdiction even when the child becomes an adult, provided the child was handicapped prior to the age of majority. The second erroneous ruling is, we had already addressed, Your Honor, is the 125C.0045. And our position is that does not prohibit support beyond the age of majority. It simply is a statute that says the court, if it's looking at the best interest, can order support while the child is the age of minority. The third erroneous ruling was that the child support orders must be continuous. And this is one of the problems that exists in this case is mom went back. I keep calling her mom. I apologize for that. But mom went back to court to get a determination early on and was told it's not right. You have to wait beyond the age of majority. So the court invited her to come back after the child reached the age of majority and then later said, I don't have an ability because the child support automatically terminated at 18 or 19. In the case of Scott v. Scott, this court held that whether the party stipulated or there was an order that said child support terminates at the age of majority, it does not interfere with the court's ability, and the court should, in fact, look at NRS 125B110 if there is a handicap present, and it was remanded back in that case.
Are you seeking relief on both the child support and the spousal support?
Yes. Yes,
sure. How does the spousal support play into the child's disability? I can understand child support, but how does spousal support jive with that?
Right, and they are very interconnected because my client needs an ability to provide for the child. So her needs to support her household changed from the time that the divorce happened until the time that she requested the alimony. So it was a bit of a belt and suspenders approach. I don't know that she's going to be.
You can't really
say, I want to get alimony to use it for child support. I mean, those are two very separate and distinct things, right? And it seems as if the claim for alimony, setting aside the child support claim right now, but the claim for alimony is really just an end run to get more child support.
Well, the claim for alimony is a means by which she could get support for the household, which has a child in it, an adult child. If the court were going to, perhaps it should have been pled in the alternative in the lower court. But if the court was going to take the position, which it did, that it didn't even have jurisdiction to issue child support, it certainly had jurisdiction to modify alimony if it made a determination that the economic circumstances warranted it and that they had changed from the time of the divorce.
But aren't the circumstances looked at from the perspective of the payor, not the payee? Changed circumstances, meaning the person who's paying, Mr. BJ, I guess we're calling him, wouldn't we be looking at it through his lens that his circumstances have changed, whether his income goes up by 20%, down by 20%, not from the perspective of the recipient, right? Under NRS 125-158, right. 150 subsection 8, I should say.
Right, and that is not my understanding of the law, Your Honor. My understanding is that any change of circumstances that impacts the economic circumstances of the parties can be considered. There's a couple of things. It says a 20%, there's a separate part of the subsection of the statute that says 20% reduction of the payor. That's a separate section from Section 8. And then Section 8 also includes a portion that says that if the court makes a finding that the person is not capable of paying that amount of child support, then they should look to modification or spousal support.
So the change circumstance for your client is that her ex-husband's no longer paying spousal support. That's the change circumstance.
The change of circumstances, that is part of it, yes. It's that she has a child who she takes care of. She's not able to go out and get a job because she has to stay home. She works from home. That was not what was anticipated at the time of the divorce. At the time of the divorce, it was anticipated, and it's part of the language in the divorce, that the parties would look into a special needs trust for the child. Subsequent to the divorce, that was refused. So she wasn't able to get the means to support the child or support the household that she understood she was probably going to get at the time of the divorce, which is, it is interconnected. And I agree. No, I think child support is the more important issue in this case.
Right, but there is no order that this special needs trust actually get established, just that the parties would look into it, right?
That's correct.
And did the parties do that?
My understanding is they did. There's a dispute as to why it didn't happen.
Okay. You want to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The rest of your time?
Good afternoon. Bradford Smith on behalf of Mr. Stanian, the respondent in this case. I want to go to the questions that were asked because I think those are the issues that are before the court and they're aptly stated. So the question here is, do we want to have a statute that has no limit? So for example, if somebody has MS and they decide that MS has arose during the time of the minority, but they don't feel any kind of symptoms of that until they're 40 years old. Under the position that the court can always go back and order support where a child no longer has the capacity to have gainful employment, that would apply. And that can't be reasonable. Edgington tells us, in many cases, tell us that the interpretation of the statute should be reasonable.
So you think the court could, prior to the 18th birthday, make a modification to child support based on a disability?
I think that the court could make a determination as to whether or not the child had gainful employment, and that's sort of the weakness of the statute.
But we're talking about before they're 18.
Before they're 18, and that is the weakness of the statute. Justice Herndon, if you look at the statute itself, it indicates the handicap of the child must have occurred before the age of the majority for his duty to apply. Nobody's disputing that there was a handicap. Yes, because handicap is defined in a particular way under the statute.
Here's what I'm getting at.
Yes.
You would agree that the court would, under your theory here, have the ability to make a child support award that's reflective of the disability if the court made that award before the child was 18, and that award could then continue on past the 18th birthday?
Right, and I think that's what Edgington tells us. But I also think, Your Honor, that the idea that the handicap must have occurred is difficult. And I don't think it accomplishes what the statute was designed to accomplish in certain circumstances. But I also think there needs to be some reasonable time frame upon which a parent can come before the court and say, we may not have known, or it may not have been clear to us based upon the child's condition at the time prior to his minority, that a condition that existed at the time of his minority would prevent him from ever being gainfully employed.
That's kind of a legislative thing, right?
That is a legislative thing, but the court, I've been before the court many times, and I would suggest to Your Honor that the court has had no problem in judicially legislating certain ramifications.
Let me ask you this as well. Under what you're proposing, assuming a court makes an award that's reflective of a disability and it's done before the child is 18, and the court's order is that can continue on past the 18th birthday because they're disabled. Assuming that child somehow evolves from that disability to be able to be gainfully employed, you would want the ability, I'm sure, to go back to court and say, now maybe that award is too high.
And that is the criteria that's stated in the statute. The second criteria that allows us to go outside of the jurisdiction normally granted to courts is the second provision, and that says that for the purpose of this section, a child is self-supporting if he receives public assistance beyond the age of majority, and that assistance is sufficient to meet his needs.
Sure.
So that allows and incentivizes parents to, prior to the time that the divorce is granted, to go out and find out whether or not there's anything wrong with their child. And I think that that's part of the intent of the legislation by saying the handicap of the child. And again, handicap is already determined in the statute, means the inability to gauge any substantial gainful activity. This statute wasn't really designed for what we have here. We have a very high-performing person on the autism scale who graduated from college, and that was addressed in our opposition to the motion that was filed.
What if anything, is in the record about the mom's inability to work outside the home and contribute to household income?
Almost nothing. It's only on one page in one paragraph in their original motion. They tried to beef up that notion afterwards by filing exhibits mostly related to the child's condition on the evening before the hearing. So in regard to the statements of the new one in regard to her condition, that's found in her brief, in which she identified things that are very common to parents. It's the respondent's brief, but the actual motion, and I'll read that into the record, Your Honor. She indicates that, actually at page 3 of the, she indicates that she can only able to generate minimal income through Golden Cross's personal care assistant for her mother because her mother resides in the home with Nuon and Alex. That is not a basis. The care for her mother is not a basis to say that she's restricted. A woman who has a PhD and a master's degree, she was working before for substantial income. The condition that she was in, though, at the time of the divorce is she had been a stay-at-home mother, and I think that was one of the questions that the court identified as part of its analysis. What is the change of circumstances that existed, and why couldn't she work during that time that was different than what happened at the time of the original divorce? And there is nothing. We know that the child suffered and was on the spectrum because Judge Hoskin indicated that in one of its orders, his orders. In that order, the court said, you need to go out and determine through a very specific reference to a doctor that was in Torrey University, you need to meet with that person and decide what abilities and lack of abilities that the child has, and I'll retain jurisdiction over that up until the time that my jurisdiction ends at 18 or otherwise 19 if he's still in, or 19 and still in high school and high school 19. Right. So we know that the court understood that there were things that the parties needed to do to determine what the court's position would be at the time of the divorce. And he said, as soon as he has majority, I'm ready to make a ruling on that. But he said not until that time, because how can I tell if at the time of majority he can't work or can't have gainful employment activity if my duty is to provide it at the time, or to say that it was in a condition, if I don't have any information regarding that condition prior to the time of his reaching majority. In other words, if I don't have that information,
How can I then make a determination that that was something that arose during the time? Just the fact, and I want to make the distinction, Justice Lee, between the idea that there was a disability or there was a handicap versus he was found to be on the autism spectrum. Those are two very different things. We have in our society many, many children who have learning disabilities of some sort, including autism, and their parents regularly go to the schools to ask for certain accommodations for that child. They ask for additional time. They ask for more testing. They ask for readers. They ask for note takers. These are very common things in our society for folks that will never be deemed to be handicapped in the way that the statute works. So in order to incentivize, if you rule that the parties can come back at any time, you've got no incentive for these parents to find out what the condition of their child is and present that to the court. The other thing that we regularly do in family law cases, and the question is, could we do that here? This is also perhaps a legislative determination, is, for example, for alimony, we regularly have what are called surrogacy provisions to prevent losing a lot of money or resources from somebody filing bankruptcy and not paying their obligations under a decree. So we allow the court to retain jurisdiction by the payment of $1 of alimony. Now, in those circumstances, we do that to afford the court jurisdiction in a circumstance we can anticipate. If the parents know that their child has a difficulty or a learning disability or is on the spectrum, how difficult would it be to say that a court must, the parent must bring that to the court and at least extend that jurisdiction so that the court had an opportunity to review in some reasonable time period what the condition of that child was?
Well, Mr. Bradford, can I just ask you, okay, so let's parse this out between child support and alimony. With child support, you would agree that 125B110 doesn't have any time limitations on it. It doesn't say that this must be filed while the child is the age of the minority, but you're saying that it has to be filed within a reasonable amount of time.
That's right.
And are you supporting that with anything, or this is just...
I would support it with the Edgington view of, and all many, many cases, view of what a statutory construction should be. If we construe a statute that it can forever be the basis for a modification of alimony based upon a handicap that they allege occurred during the time of marriage, it's not reasonable.
Did the court make a determination of reasonableness, or did the court just say because it wasn't brought pursuant to 125C0045 and the reading those statutes together, I don't have any jurisdiction because it wasn't filed while the child was the age of minority? That seems to be what the judge is saying, but I don't think that's what 110 requires.
I don't think that I think that the court found that Judge Hoskin had stated, and this is not disputed, in his final order addressing the condition of the child that was done prior to the child's minority, he stated that his majority would end, and that would be the end of his ability to, or the time of his ability to address this. There was still time between the time of his majority and the time when child support stopped that they could have come before. And they knew.
Because he was still in high school.
Right. They were still in high school for 6 months.
Okay.
So they had adequate reason to come before the court. I don't understand the explanation that they had to 2 years later, when the child was 20, go to seek social programs. They should have done that as part of their duty under 125B110. It seems to me that the burden should be placed upon the parent seeking the support to show that, one, that the support was, or that the handicap was there during the time of the minority of the child, and secondly, that they acted in a reasonable time under the statute, because, again, any kind of notion that they can act ever would be an unreasonable way to address the statute.
And then for alimony, sorry, I just wanted to finish up my two-part question here. With alimony, my understanding is that she did get her motion in under the radar, as a practitioner, I know, you know, you have till 11:59 to file something. And if you get in at 11:59, it's timely. So how do you address the court's ruling saying, you know, that it doesn't have jurisdiction over that portion
of it.
Well,
let me say first, the court did have jurisdiction. I don't think the court had indicated it had no jurisdiction. I think the court found specifically
that she did not
show a change of circumstances. And that's what I was getting before earlier, is that there was no change. The child was still in the same condition that he was at the time that he was in, arguably in his minority, when he wasn't as developed and wasn't going to school and college and things, doing the things that he was doing, that he was at, there was greater need. But nevertheless, the court doesn't need to find that. The court needs to just find that there's a change. There wasn't a change in the child. And she really used that change. She just said that it really did focus, Justice Lee, as you've read the papers, it focused solely on the issue of whether or not she could support the child. And that is a different question. And I would suggest that there are statements in there that were contrary to her interest. The idea that I can't work because I got to take care of my mother, I don't think is a consideration for alimony. I think that there is other kind of care that's available for both children or even adults of that have needs and older adults that have needs. She should have focused on actually getting her employment to a position where she could, make a living that was considerable or consistent with her needs. Let me also say that it was very clear from the evidence that her statement of her needs was wildly blown out of proportion. She lived in a 4,500 square foot house. This is in the record. She drove a late model car. She spent money for, you know, significant sums on not just the child or herself, but for others. There was just a number of factors that the court could weigh and see that there weren't a preponderance of evidence, or there wasn't a basis for preponderance of evidence. Let me get this sort of commercial in for the judges who I've talked about. The judges in our family courts are overworked by a huge amount. And for them to be required to have an evidentiary hearing, even when the proffers of proof are insufficient, is a significant burden. This is not a scientific study, but I can tell you just from my experience of doing this for as long as I have, they are prepared to rule in certain circumstances where the proffers are just so deficient that they can rule on the issue. And I think we should be very careful about telling them in any circumstance involving questions of fact that they must have an evidentiary hearing, because for most folks, for well-heeled folks, it's no big deal. But for most folks, the litigation costs prevent them from getting justice. They can't afford to go further. In fact, you had the argument, although I don't believe it's consistent with this record, that she didn't file because she didn't have the money to file. And if we place the burden upon every circumstance that the judge should have an evidentiary hearing, I don't think that you're going to get the kind of results that you want. You're going to get what we see now, 30-minute hearings. It's absurd. We see people who can't afford it. So thank
May
you.
I ask Chief Justice Lynch? Go ahead. So what about, and I understand not an evidentiary hearing in every situation, but here where mom is possibly burdened with having to financially support this child in perpetuity, and the statute's compulsory language, right? So it says a parent shall support beyond the age of majority. So how are we supposed to construe that within the context of these proceedings?
Well, that support is based upon Edgington's finding that this was just an extension of the obligation of support under the statutory scheme. If you really want to do us a favor, should identify what the metric is for what that support will be, because now it's just up in the air. So there's nothing. But in this circumstance, if you say that she can just say that she needs this support and therefore I can't meet his needs without any showing other than the Social Security request of what other services were available to her. You'll see in her appendix there are services from various state agencies. And those state agencies, a simple review of their website, they offer home and care for disabled children or adults. They offer all kinds of services, none of which were presented to the court. I would just say that the court, under the circumstances it had, made a ruling that made sense.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I'll try to address some of the things that were said. One, with regard to my client's education, having a PhD, this was a 26-year marriage where she was a stay-at-home mom. So it wasn't as if she could use her PhD that was by that time 30 years old to go back to work when her child was autistic and severely impaired, according to the Social Security Administration. In terms of the language that they would utilize a doctor, that Judge Hoskins said you need to utilize the doctor on issues of autism, that is true, but that was for joint legal custody decisions. It didn't have anything to do with child support. It had to do with whether they had a disagreement. He didn't want them to come back into court, and that's evident in the record as well. Another issue is that, you know, there's much made that, hey, you should ask the court early on. My client pled in her complaint for divorce NRS 125B110, which is not common at all. She wanted a finding from the court at that time. It didn't occur in the decree of divorce. She filed a motion essentially within a month of the decree being entered saying, this issue was missed. We need to make a determination here. And that's when Judge Hoskin issued an order saying, come back beyond the age of majority. And I agree, it's going to be very difficult to determine what the time scale is as to when you can come back or what's reasonable, these things. I agree with Justice Lee that it's a shall. It's you shall support your child. Now, if there are questions of did they seek services, are the services adequate, those are all evidentiary questions. To expect a person in family court to come back and put everything in the motion that could possibly be in there, there just needs to be some adequate showing that an evidentiary hearing is necessary. And our position is that there was certainly adequate showing just on the Social Security disability alone, but on other things, there was no dispute that the child had autism. There's no dispute to many of the facts that would let the court have an evidentiary.
But autism doesn't necessarily mean a handicap per the statute, right?
Sure, the Social Security Administration finding does, because it mirrors what our case law says. If there's a defense to these things, it's more of a laches defense or some sort of equitable defense. It's not built within the statute. And that's kind of our position, is if you want to raise those defenses and the court sees that those defenses are legitimate, and I don't know that they are under the statute because I still think it's a shall statute, but it's not legislated into the statute that there's this finite amount of time that you have to come back. In terms of litigation costs, at the time of the divorce, the respondent, he was making $30,000 a month. When our client filed to extend her alimony, and you had mentioned this earlier, Justice Lee, isn't it based on his income being reduced? There's an EDCR that requires you to file a financial disclosure form. He didn't file a financial disclosure form. So we don't know what his income was at the time. And Judge Ochoa rejected it anyways and didn't even, that's all evidence that should have been heard. There should have been factual findings. And with that, I'll submit. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
All right. Thank you both, gentlemen. I appreciate your arguments today as well as the